and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 30th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, the first fruits of MESSENGER's orbit of Mercury, mood patterns tracked through social media, and computer games that aid the blind, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Since entering orbit of the planet Mercury in March 2011, NASA's MESSENGER spacecraft, the first ever to orbit the planet, has acquired unprecedented high-resolution images and spectral and other data. The new observations have given scientists back on Earth their most detailed look yet at Mercury's composition, magnetosphere, and origin. Sean Solomon, principal investigator of the MESSENGER mission, spoke with me about some of the findings.
MESSENGER has been flying for more than 7 years. We launched in August of 2004, and the spacecraft made 6 planetary flybys, 1 of Earth, 2 of Venus, and 3 of Mercury. Those last 3 were very important for us because they gave us the close view for the first time since Mariner 10 of Mercury and allowed us to train each of our instruments on the planet in anticipation of orbital observations. And, of course, MESSENGER went into orbit around the innermost planet in March of this year and was, at that point, the first spacecraft ever to orbit the planet Mercury.
And, of course, it's been gathering data in that orbital mission, and that's what's being reported here in these papers in Science. Before we dive into those, though, why study Mercury at all? What's the rationale there?
The basic rationale is that Mercury is a sister planet to Earth, Venus, and Mars. It is the smallest planet. It's the closest planet to the Sun. But it formed out of the same general processes that produced Earth. And yet, it turned out very different. It ended up being made out of the densest materials of any of the planets. And it has an Earth-like magnetic field, although a miniature version, despite being so small. It has a lunar-like, heavily cratered surface, despite having a common ancestry with Earth and the other inner planets. So it's an unusual body, and we wanted to do a proper global set of observations to put one of the sibling planets of Earth into complete context and begin to understand how all of the bodies in the inner solar system formed and what made them turn out as different as they are.
And I got the impression, as you did that analysis, it looked like this probe uncovered quite a few surprises in Mercury. The composition, for starters, looks kind of distinctive from the other terrestrial planets. Is that correct?
It is indeed, Stuart, and it's full of surprises. The chemistry that we are uncovering with our various chemical remote sensing instruments. We did know for many years that Mercury has a much higher density when you correct for internal compression than any of the other planets, and the only element sufficiently abundant in the Sun and in the starting materials that formed the planets to account for that high density is iron. And so on that basis, we have known that Mercury has a much larger fraction of iron metal than Earth or the other inner planets. And the idea is,
and just if I could interrupt you, that's based strictly on like the orbital dynamics of Mercury, or how was the density determined to be?
The density was determined initially from the orbits of all the other planets and the astronomical observations of the size of Mercury, its radius. So you get the mass from the perturbation of the other planets, and you get the radius from astronomical observations. Then, of course, Mariner 10 flew by and gave us a much better measure of Mercury's mass and radius, and therefore density.
Anyway, so we knew about the iron. And
yes, knowing that the planet ended up so rich in metallic iron demanded some explanation for how a planet otherwise like Earth or Venus or Mars ended up mostly metal-rich. And those ideas, which have been in the literature now for several decades, almost all of them invoked high-temperature processes. Mercury, for instance, by one idea, was postulated to be bathed in a very hot solar nebula of dust and gas that surrounded the early Sun that boiled off the outer part of the outer rocky part of the planet, leaving a planet more enriched in metal. Another idea was that a giant impact of a body nearly as large as Mercury hit the planet after it had segregated central metal core from the outer silicate shell, again, blasting off the rocky outer parts and leaving a metal-rich planet. Both of those ideas predicted that Mercury would have a composition that gave us signs that the early history of the planet had been through very high temperature processes. What MESSENGER is showing us is that the predictions of those models are not borne out. We see elements on the surface of Mercury that are what the geochemists call volatile species, ones that should have been driven off by high temperatures, such as potassium, such as sulfur. So the presence in abundance of potassium and sulfur on the surface of Mercury says that it didn't experience the truly high temperature history that has been thought likely on the basis of ideas for how Mercury was assembled, now decades old. But some other origin led to inclusion not only of the high-temperature rocky and metallic components that we knew were there, but these volatile constituents as well. And so we're having to completely rethink all of the ideas for how the innermost planet, the planet closest to the Sun, was assembled at about the same time that Earth and Venus and Mars were also forming.
Well, there was also some imaging of the surface features from the probe as well. Did they cast any light on these problems?
What we're learning from the imaging is that the perspective that the spacecraft gives us from orbit and the ability to take much higher resolution images than we could even during the flybys is also rewriting our understanding of the geologic history of the planet. So we're seeing evidence for huge outpourings of lavas in the ancient geological past of Mercury, what on Earth we would call flood lava eruptions, where large areas are inundated to depths of several kilometers by molten rock over geologically short intervals of time. And that these erupting lavas are so hot that they actually cut down, they melt their way down into the substrate and create their own channels for flowing over the surface. We're seeing more examples of explosive volcanic eruptions of the sort that are driven by the release from the erupting magmas of gases, again fingering volatiles in the interior of Mercury that helped fuel these kinds of eruptions. And the very highest resolution images that we've taken reveal a landform that we didn't even know was present on Mercury. We're calling them hollows. And these are irregular depressions that are rimless and form in very bright deposits that have been excavated by impact craters. And there are so many of these depressions next to one another across these deposits that the best explanation for accounting for the relative youth of the surface and the geometry of the surface is that material is subliming off of these very bright deposits within the craters, fingering a constituent of these deposits that must be sufficiently easily volatilized to be driven off by the high temperatures during Mercury's day, or perhaps driven off by impact by solar wind ions. We're not sure which, but it's yet another manifestation of volatile constituents inside Mercury, so underscoring the realization, the great surprise, that Mercury is not made out of the materials we thought it is, but compositionally and geologically has had a very different history.
And I suppose in some sense, some of what you're talking about, we tend to think of Mercury as sort of almost a dead planet, I guess, in a way. It sounds like at least at some point in the past, it was pretty lively.
At some point in the past, it was very lively with volcanic eruptions, with huge faults forming all over the surface. But this creation of these hollows and the bright deposits within impact craters, that may be a very modern process. And it's quite conceivable that Mercury, quite independent of the impact cratering that's going on more or less all the time, is still geologically active today in the sense of changing the surface by loss of volatile-rich materials that have been brought to the surface from depth by these large impact craters.
And I think there's a lot of data that MESSENGER has come up with now about Mercury's magnetosphere and outer atmosphere. Can you tell us something about that?
I can. Mercury has a fascinating atmosphere because it's constantly being lost to space and renewed by surface processes. It's extremely dynamic. The magnetosphere, the envelope of space surrounding the planet that's dominated by the planet's magnetic field rather than the interplanetary magnetic field, is small because Mercury's field is weak, but it's a miniature of that of Earth. And so the combination of size but similarity to Earth is giving us a lot of new understanding of Earth-like magnetospheres in general. The magnetic field of Mercury, although somewhat Earth-like, has another surprise that was just revealed, and that is that, like the Earth's field, it is dominantly the field of a dipole, the equivalent to a bar magnet, near the center of the planet. But unlike the Earth, where that bar magnet is very close to the Earth's center, on Mercury, that bar magnet is substantially offset to the north along the spin axis of the planet, so that the magnetic field at the surface in the northern hemisphere is much stronger than in the southern hemisphere.
That's interesting. So, you know, whereas the Earth's magnetic field is kind of associated with the central core, something different, presumably, is happening at Mercury.
Well, at Mercury, it's still associated with the core. We think it still arises from processes within a fluid iron core, as it does on the Earth. But the geometry of the field is different from that of the Earth, and therefore the specifics of that generation mechanism are very different on Mercury from Earth, and it will be fascinating to try to understand that in terms of numerical models of how these fields are generated.
Well, what's next for MESSENGER?
Well, we're halfway through our primary orbital mission. We've got another 6 months of observations to go, and a lot of our campaigns will be needing the full 12 months of observations in order to acquire information needed to answer some of the questions that frame the mission. We also have a proposal into NASA for an extended mission. We haven't heard yet on that proposal, but there are a lot of things that we can do differently at Mercury now that we've seen the planet close up for the first time. And on top of that, the sun continues to be increasingly active as we're nearing the peak of the solar cycle. And because Mercury is so close to the sun has an unusually strong influence on the planet, on the magnetosphere, on the exosphere, and on the surface. And having an observatory right there to watch these phenomena as the sun becomes more and more active, as solar flares get more and more energetic, will be a fascinating view of how the closest planets interact with active stars.
Well, something for us all to look forward to. Sean Solomon, thanks very much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Sean Solomon is the principal investigator of the MESSENGER mission. The full package of 7 articles about MESSENGER's findings, published today in Science, along with a news article on the mission, can be found at www.sciencemag.org/hottopics/messenger. A study published this week in Science has used a popular social media tool to analyze mood fluctuations among individuals from across the globe. Here's Carrie with the story.
Lazy Sunday, case of the Mondays, winter blues, dog days of summer. We've all heard the idioms about the moods that certain periods bring on, but what drives these fluctuations? Are they related to our biological rhythms or to our environment? In response to these questions, Cornell sociologist Scott Golder turned to an unusual data source, social media.
We collected a massive archive of Twitter messages, of about 500 million messages, and we used them to explore the daily and the weekly variations in the mood or the affect of people from across the globe.
Twitter, a social networking website, allows users to post brief, time-stamped comments to the public at large. To Golder and co-author Michael Macy, whose goal was to study the patterns in mood across a diverse population of individuals over time, Twitter looked like a potentially ideal window into users' emotions at an exact moment. Golder categorizes these feelings as positive, like delight, enthusiasm, and alertness, or negative, such as disgust, anxiety, and fear. Although positives and negatives are sometimes viewed as polar opposites, Golder says the reality is more complicated.
We often think of things as being good or bad or positive or negative, and so it might seem intuitive that positive affect is the opposite of negative affect, and psychologists are realizing that this is not actually the case. For example, if you were experiencing high alertness and high disgust at the same time, you could measure high on both positive and negative affect at the same time. Conversely, you could also be experiencing low negative and positive affect at the same time. So it's really important to explore them as independent dimensions.
Unlike conventional psychological methods, which can be hampered by sample size issues and cumbersome data collection, social media offered the ability to sample, unobtrusively, a massive, diverse, publicly available database of human moods. From February 2008 to January 2010, Golder and Macy collected 506 million Twitter posts, or tweets, from 2.4 million active Twitter users. But how can something as complicated as mood be derived from the 140 characters of text allowed in each tweet? Using a text analysis tool called Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count, the scientists classified emotional buzzwords in each post as either positive,
agreement, awesome, definitely, pretty, fantastic, funny, special,
or negative,
cynical, aching, raging, remorse, panic, afraid, abandonment.
Golder and Macy then compiled all messages posted at each time of day and graphed their collective positive and negative measures over time. They found that the collective mood tracked a definite pattern over the course of each day of the week.
We saw that positive affect or positive mood peaks in the morning and decreases throughout the course of the day and is highest again at night. And when we talked with lay people about this, they said, well, of course, people hate going to work, and so their affect is going to be lowest during the day. And that's a pretty compelling reason, except we noticed that the rhythm was the same shape on the weekend as on the weekday. So any variation that we were seeing couldn't be attributed to the normative 9-to-5 Monday to Friday work week if we're observing the same shape of the rhythm on the weekend as well.
When Golder and Macy initially collected Twitter posts, they also cataloged each user's location data. Their 2.4 million Twitter users live in 84 different countries, and the similarities in their affective rhythms were striking.
Of course, there are variations, but we were impressed with how similar these different countries look to one another, given that they vary in many dimensions. They vary in socioeconomic status. They vary in government structure. They vary in just cultural dimensions that are too numerous to even begin to contemplate.
The group that strayed the furthest from the average affective pattern was the so-called night owls, who have dramatically shifted their schedules of activity and sleep away from the norm.
They had very different shapes to their positive and negative affect rhythm, suggesting that there's something about being out of sync scheduling-wise with the rest of the population that may be related to being out of sync affectively with the rest of the population.
Looking over the course of the year, Golder and Macy also found that the affective levels did not correlate with the length of day quite as expected.
We also found that seasonally, positive affect is associated with the lengthening of days rather than the amount of daylight or of the absolute length of the day. And this is important in research in what's commonly called the winter blues or seasonal affective disorder.
In large part, the team's results indicate that internal biology and circadian rhythms play a tremendous role in mood fluctuations over time, but suggest that seasonal affective disorder, in which individuals suffer from more negative affect during the winter months, may not be dependent solely on length of exposure to sunlight. Despite these revealing results, tapping into social media is not without its drawbacks.
The big question, I think, is, are we measuring what we believe we're measuring? First of all, we're measuring the expression of affect. We're measuring what people are saying. We're not inside their heads measuring what they are feeling.
And, continues Golder, cultural and situational inhibitions may prevent individuals from publicly discussing some activities and moods.
We have a pretty good idea of when people are doing things like eating breakfast. We know when they're stuck in traffic. We know when they're doing homework. We don't know when they're using the bathroom. People just don't tweet about certain activities. And to the extent that people don't tweet about something, we don't know about it.
What's more, some sociologists think that the text analysis tool used by Golder and Macy is lacking in refinement. Peter Sheridan Dodds is a sociologist who wasn't involved in this study, but who heads up his own social media research at the University of Vermont.
Many other studies, including this one, use minus one, zero, plus one, if you like, for whether words are negative, neutral, or positive. So that means a word like terrorist is a negative one, and so is the word unhappy. So there's a coarseness as a result that comes out of these instruments. So I think, you know, that's a limitation because, you know, words definitely should be on a scale. Another criticism of all of these works is that And they address it to some extent, and we all try to address it to some extent. But if you say, I'm not happy, then you get the words not and happy as separate words. But clearly not happy is the piece that goes together.
But, Dodds continues, Golder's methodology is sufficient to extract a basic pattern and one that is new to this field of study.
Just being able to extract a signal from these massive data sets is really an amazing achievement. You know, I think perhaps quite surprising. You might not have thought this could have happened 20 years ago. Certainly the data wouldn't be there. And then to think on top of it, you might be able to extract something like emotion.
Golder agrees.
One of the most important things about what we were able to do, I think, is it shows what's in store for the future of social science research. I think we'll always want to do small group surveys, interviews, things like that. But on the other hand, I think there's really tremendous power coming from the use of internet data.
As for the future, Golder envisions creating an interactive temporal database of moods and behaviors for use by the general public. Dodds, meanwhile, has his eye on further refining the affective patterns determined by Golder and other social media studies.
And then the biggest story is, well, what do these effects mean? So what do these numbers mean? So we know what 70 degrees Fahrenheit means versus 100 degrees versus 32. We have very good experiential understanding of those numbers. So we hear a weather report. We know what to do with ourselves to get dressed in a certain way. But if we get a number about the state of society based on one of these measures of happiness, it's a 6.3 or something like this, we need to at some point start to figure out what those numbers really mean. You know, if it goes up by 10%, is that a lot? I don't think any of us have figured those things out.
For Science, this is Carrie Klein.
You can find the paper by Scott Golder and Michael Macy, Diurnal and Seasonal Mood Vary with Work, Sleep, and Day Length Across Diverse Cultures, in this week's Science. A news focus this week explores a computer game in which the user must navigate an unknown building filled with dangerous monsters, all without the benefit of sight. It's a concept scientists are developing to help the blind find their way in a complex world, and that's also casting light on the neuroscience of sightlessness. Science's Sarah Reardon visited one of the participating labs and spoke with me about the research.
This is a story about some researchers in Boston and at the University of Chile who are trying to develop audio-based video games that kind of recreate a virtual world, like a first-person shooter type game. But instead of seeing yourself walking through a maze, you hear on either side where the walls are, where the monsters are. And what they're doing with these is recreating real buildings, building these in real places so that children who are blind can play these games and learn how to navigate a real space based on the auditory view instead of a visual three-dimensional space.
Okay, so this program, this audio-based environment simulator, I think it's called, how did this get started?
Well, this got started actually quite a long time ago, back in the 90s, when a first-person shooter game called Doom came out. It was the first ever three-dimensional first-person shooter. It was very, very popular. There's a researcher named Jamie Sanchez at the University of Chile who'd been doing some research on developing educational games for disabled kids. And he was interested in trying to figure out whether blind children could use an audio-based version of this game if they would be able to play the game and navigate the maze, because the key to winning Doom was to navigate this very complex maze. And so he made an audio-based version of Doom. It had monsters running through it, and you could shoot the monsters, but you'd be hearing in one earphone or the other what was going on. And he gave it to some kids, had them play it, and they turned out to be perfectly able to navigate this game using only sound. And then when he gave these blind children Legos, they were able to reconstruct the map from memory of the entire game.
And these were children who had been basically blind since birth. I gather that sighted children didn't do too well with these audio-based games.
No, they didn't at all.
Well, you got a chance to watch someone in action playing this game and the impact it had on their ability to navigate. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, it was actually very interesting. I went up to Boston at the Center for the Blind, where a researcher named Lotfi Maribet has taken the game to the next stage, rather than just seeing whether the blind children can navigate the game and whether they can recreate the maze. He puts them in this three-dimensional virtual auditory environment that is actually based on a building on the campus. And then they go from the game to this actual building that they've never been in before, and they can navigate it perfectly well. And I played the game myself. It was very interesting. I was not very good at it, but one of the blind students who I saw play and navigate, she had learned this maze very well and could navigate the building easily.
So the practical application here, the one regarding navigation, is pretty remarkable, but I guess there's some neuroscience going on here as well.
Yes, that's something that a lot of researchers are very interested in looking into, is how blind people, especially those who have been blind since birth and have never used the visual cortex of their brain, which is a pretty big area that they don't use for its sort of evolutionarily intended purpose, seeing, they can use this space for something else. There's been a lot of research showing that they will use it for reading Braille or for processing language, and apparently they can also use it for navigating and creating these cognitive maps that we would create using our vision, but they need to create in another way. And so they're doing functional MRI studies of some of these blind students while they play the game and trying to figure out what parts of their brain are activated, what happens when they have to turn a corner, what happens when they encounter a monster, do they need to make a split-second decision. And at least from their preliminary data, it turns out that those patterns that they're using to make these decisions are very different from those that a sighted person would use when they play the game.
So where is all this headed?
Well, they're continuing to look into the neuroscience and try to figure out how a blind person's brain constructs these maps. And it also has a lot of potential, they think, as a rehab tool for people who have become blind or people who are blind and about to go to a new place. If you can have a map of that place that's auditory-based ahead of time, you can learn how to navigate, say, a university or a mall or some other place where you might want to go that might be very difficult to get around if you're blind, especially if it's indoors and you can't bring a dog in, you can't use a GPS-based system. If you can play this game ahead of time, which it's a fun game, and learn how to make this map, then you can go there and navigate much more easily.
Sarah Reardon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Reardon writes about computer games aiding the blind in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to round up some recent stories from our daily news site. So, in our first story, we've got something called the teleportation effect. What is that all about?
Right. Well, this actually, unfortunately, has nothing to do with Star Trek. It has to do with, I don't care if you've ever stepped out of an elevator on the wrong floor and you've got that momentary confusion. You think you should be on one floor, but it doesn't look familiar to you.
Far too often.
Exactly. It happens to me, too. And researchers call this the teleportation effect. The idea is that we are momentarily confused about where we are. And they're trying to figure out, in this study, basically what underlies that effect, what is sort of going on in our brain when that happens. And so instead of using people stepping out of the wrong floor of elevators, they actually looked at rats thinking they were in the wrong part of essentially what was an experimental maze.
So how can scientists actually set up an experiment like this?
So what they did was they basically created two boxes that the rats could run between. And one box had a circle of white light emitting diodes shining through the clear floor of the box. And the other box had a row of green LEDs around the ceiling. So for the rats, they could clearly tell, I'm in the white box or I'm in the green box. And then what the researchers did is they had the rats run back and forth between the boxes a few times just to get a sense of the two boxes. And then they played a little trick on the rats once the rats were used to this. They had the rats in one of the boxes, let's say the white box, and they put some cookie crumbles in the green box. So the rats start going towards the green box, but then all of a sudden the researchers switch the lights so that the white box that the rats were in all of a sudden became the green box. And so for the rats, it was almost like they had teleported instantaneously to the green box, even though they shouldn't have been there for at least a few more footsteps. And lo and behold, this rats appear to have experienced this teleportation effect in their brain. The researchers noticed that there was sort of a war going on between the firing pattern of certain neurons. One group of neurons was firing with the pattern that it had used in the white box. So part of the rat's brain was telling it, okay, you're in the white box. But another group was firing in a pattern that was corresponding to the green box. So part of the rat's brain was saying, hey, no, wait, you're in the green box. And this war actually went on for about 125 milliseconds, which doesn't sound like very long, and it isn't very long, but it was long enough to probably create that temporary confusion that we feel. And more importantly, it suggests that the brain stores memories into these discrete 125 millisecond packages. And when you disrupt what the brain is trying to keep track of, these packages sort of get confused as well, and you feel like you're somewhere you shouldn't be.
So is there an analog to how this actually works in human brains?
Well, that's the big question. You know, is this exactly analogous to what happens in people? And researchers don't know that yet. Although in humans, there's something known as theta waves, which is basically the rhythm in which your brain cells fire in. And so researchers are interested in this because if there's disruptions in the theta waves, that could also have implications for cognitive disorders like Alzheimer's disease and other problems. So far, researchers have just, quote unquote, teleported rats. They haven't really studied this in humans yet. But if there are analogs for humans, it could shed light on a lot of things that are going on inside the human brain.
And now in our second story, we have a potential health risk that doesn't originate on Earth.
Right. Well, from fake space to real space here, this next story is actually about interstellar travel, or at least interplanetary travel, perhaps. This story is about something known as space weather. And kind of like Earth weather, space weather is sort of the conditions that occur outside of Earth's atmosphere. And a lot of times when researchers are talking about space weather, they talk about two types of things. One is galactic cosmic rays. And these are the protons and ions that rain down at near light speed from space. The other one is known as solar energetic particles. And these basically are coming from the sun. These are particles that come in bursts from our own star. And both of these things are kind of not great news because they both contain a lot of radiation. They can be harmful for us in large doses. This is especially a concern for people that take a lot of flights where you're sort of in the upper atmosphere and you're exposed to a lot more of these rays. The other problem in the future is for long-term space missions. There's been talk about sending astronauts to Mars, and this is a several-month mission. And scientists are concerned that having astronauts in space for this long, especially when you have all of these solar energetic particles and galactic cosmic rays going on, that could be really harmful.
So people already take a lot of flights now. We do have astronauts going to space occasionally. What might be different about the future?
Well, so that's what this new study is all about. Researchers looked back historically at evidence of these GRCs, the galactic cosmic rays, and the SEPs, the solar energetic particles. And what they already sort of knew was that these solar energetic particles are both sort of good news and bad news. When the sun gets very active and is emitting a lot of these particles, it sort of ensheaths our solar system in this kind of blanket that's known as the heliosphere. And that actually shields us from the GRCs, which is good. But the problem is the SEPs are bad too. And what the researchers are trying to figure out is what's going to be this balance of SEPs to GRCs in the future. And by looking back at this historical data, they found some not so great news. The researchers found that during periods of what they call middling solar activity, this is really the worst time for SEPs because there's fewer SEP events, but the events there are far more intense. And it turns out that we are actually entering a period of middling solar activity. So the researchers say that these SEP events could become much more dangerous in the future.
Plus, I can imagine in the periods between these events that we might have an increase in GRCs bombarding the atmosphere as well.
Right. And so the researchers are really sort of concerned about both of these. Now, what does this mean for astronauts and frequent flyers? Well, the researcher says that frequent flyers right now, people that take long-haul flights that tend to go near Earth's poles, they can take about 5 of these flights a year and still be within safe radiation levels. But in the future, because of the increase in dangerous space weather, the safe number of flights could be reduced to just 2. And similarly, for astronauts that are going to go on long-haul missions like missions to Mars, researchers have calculated that a mission to Mars would probably give you all the radiation that you would safely consume or safely be exposed to in your entire life. So you're really just pushing the limits there. That's how things are now. But if the space weather gets as bad as this new study suggests, then astronauts might be exposed to as much as 2 times that amount of radiation, which could be dangerous. So for future space missions, researchers are really going to have to find a way to better protect astronauts from space weather.
Well, I'll cross that Mars trip off of my list. And in our last story today, it sounds like the science of code making keeps evolving.
Right. And I feel like we're on a science fiction theme, so we'll sort of end out on that as well. This last story is about getting bacteria to encode secret messages. And this project that this study is all about actually came about from a request from the U.S. government for researchers to find ways to encode secret messages without the need for electronics.
So how does it work?
So basically what these researchers did in this study was their non-electronics are actually bacteria. And what they did was they took a bunch of different colonies of E. coli bacteria. And these are bacteria that are very common. We actually have them in our gut and they're in our food and they're all over the place. But they gave each of these colonies a gene for a different fluorescent protein. So some of the colonies glowed yellow, some glowed green, some glowed red, what have you. And the colors really varied on the types of genes that were expressed. And all these colors are visible to the naked eye, so you can actually see these red glowing bacteria. You can actually see a picture of these bacteria growing on the site. And then when the researchers had these colonies that were glowing all these different colors, they found that they could arrange them in several different combinations so that they were actually able to create codes for the 26 different letters of the alphabet and 23 alphanumeric symbols. And they were able to write messages with these bacteria.
Okay, so I understand in theory how you could color code bacteria, but how do you actually make a code and then receive and decrypt this code?
Well, it's a great question. And so for espionage purposes, what the researchers say you would need to do is you basically take your colonies and you plate these bacteria on a plate of agar, which is basically bacteria food. And then you press a sheet of nitrocellulose paper on top of that bacteria, and that basically immobilizes the bacteria. And at this point, you've got, because the genes aren't turned down, you've got bacteria on this nitrocellulose paper, but you don't see anything because they're not glowing. So you give that paper to your secret agent, and he passes it on to another secret agent. And basically what happens is that when the recipient gets this piece of nitrocellulose paper, they add whatever they need to add to the bacteria to get those fluorescent genes expressed. And you've got this clear piece of nitrocellulose paper that all of a sudden becomes live with various different colors, and the agent or whoever decodes those colors or the patterns of the colors to decode the message. And there's actually one more cool step the researchers added. They made some of the bacteria resistant to particular antibiotics. So if the wrong person gets a hold of this nitrocellulose paper and just tries to activate all the glowing genes, he or she is basically going to get this jumbled mess of glowing that doesn't really mean anything. But if the right person gets it, that person will know to add a specific antibiotic, killing off the bacteria that are sort of confusing the signal. And what you end up with is a nice clear signal of whatever your secret code is. Now, in this paper, the secret code tended to be something very mundane. It said, "This is a bio-encoded message from the Walt Lab at Tufts University 2010. So not exactly the stuff of James Bond, but clearly there's a lot of potential in here.
All right. So what else has been in the news this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how light from galaxy clusters are helping confirm Einstein's theory of general relativity. Also, a story about how a koala's bellow reveals its size. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the National Medal of Science winners that have just been announced. So if you want to see who's on the list, check that out on the site. Also, we've got a story about a reaction to the big XMRV story that broke last week. This is the story that basically puts a nail in the coffin of the idea that XMRV causes chronic fatigue syndrome. The item sort of talks about what the reaction to that has been in the chronic fatigue syndrome community. Finally, on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about those faster-than-light neutrinos you may have heard about last week. What's up with them? Has the speed limit of light actually been broken, or is something much more mundane going on? So to find out, check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the September 30th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.